Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's January 14th, 2018, and welcome to episode 164 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, this is one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and friendship. I think it's about friendship and caring. And when you need a ton of caring,
oh God,
who should you chat with but caring ton?
Oh.
So first,
no, if you want a ton of caring, it should not be me. You're going to be sorely disappointed. I am ironically named.
So, Carrington, sir, how are you? Our Canadian contingent.
Screw you all. I got your caring right here. I'm doing fantastic. I'm really happy to be back on the mic with you guys. It's been ages since I've been able to make our regular Sunday outing. So I'm thrilled to be here.
Yes, and it's great to have you here. And, you know, next I'll jump over to Paul Hagstrom, who I have to admit I have a little bit more fear for. Paul, that on Twitter, that was your office we were seeing a photograph of, right? So I'm glad that you live in a zone that's not seismically active, because otherwise you could be buried by your collection.
Very
at
true.
Some point.
Yes.
But how are you?
Oh, I'm good. I'm in the academic world, and right now we're sort of in that space between semesters, but it's about to get crazy, so I'm trying to brace myself for that.
Gotcha. Looking forward to the tailgate parties and that kind of...
Yep. I've never left college.
Excellent. That would be my goal. I love going to university, but they eventually kicked me out, you know, when I didn't pay. So... Now let's chat with our friend from the future, the man for whom Sunday is always Monday, Michael Mulhern. Michael, it's good to have you on the show. What's going on in your
Hello,
world?
Hello, everybody. Life happens here, but just the usual bushfire dangers, searing hot days, you know, 40 plus degrees centigrade. It's just lovely here in Sydney, so good sunburn weather. I believe that's exactly what you guys aren't having.
Yes. So mm-hmm. not only are you one day into the future, but you're also 6 months into the future, it would seem. This is great.
Or possibly post-apocalyptically into the future.
Yeah.
I didn't get any SMS messages about incoming heat generators.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. If you're listening to this podcast, you know, several weeks after the fact, it might not be as interesting, but wow. We're not a news podcast, but that bears mentioning that there was an erroneous alert sent out to residents of Hawaii of an inbound ballistic missile with recommendations to seek shelter and an admonition that this is not a drill. And talk about a computer mess up. Right? They said it happened when there was a shift change or something like that. I bet for someone there was a permanent shift change due to all of that.
Yeah. I don't know about computer error. That kind of stuff up really takes a human.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, so my goodness.
It is interesting that we now know what would happen. You know, I mean, everybody gets a text message.
I guess.
All the Apple iPhone owners survive.
It's a class system.
Oh, man. Yeah. If you can't afford an iPhone, then... Oh, my goodness gracious.
Yeah.
Well, it is the beginning of a new year. So for our Japanese listeners, akemashite omedetou gozaimasu, which basically means, hey, what's up? It doesn't. But we like to start the new year with goals. And usually, as Michael mentioned before we started recording, they're just the goals we had for last year that we didn't do. But I thought I'd go around the table and find out from you guys, what in the world are you going to do with retro computing in 2018? What sort of projects do you have on your horizon? How are you going to enjoy this intrepid hobby of ours? Paul, why don't I start with you? And again, you know, maybe one of your goals would be to not be crushed
yes.
by your collection, but there must be other things besides that. What do you say?
Yeah, I was just thinking so contextually again in the the timeline of this recording, just I think a couple days ago, maybe yesterday or something, Burger Becky Heinemann posted a question saying, do you have a vintage computer on your desk? You know, reply with a picture or something. And so I posted a photo of this, of my desk, which actually is, it's not just from yesterday, but it's from recently. And it looks insane, you know, when you when you look at it, just because it's these stacks 3 to 5 high of computers just in the entire, you know, U shape of my desk. So, yeah, one of the things I do want to do is... well, reduce the number of things a bit, you know, just down to the, so that I have not more than 2 of anything. I'm not sure that may be more than I can do in the year. But another thing I actually really want to do is get through the scanning, because that's a lot of what I have collected. I have collected in this, what I tell myself, in this idea of preserving things, right? And so my hope is that I will do that preservation and then get them off to people who actually want to have the things to hold. Because for me, you know, a lot of the stuff I have a lot, and it's cool, and you know, I do want to document it and preserve it, but then it's just going to sit in a box or a file cabinet, and that's not interesting. Somebody else will care more about it than me. So this is not a new goal. This is probably true last year too, but I'm, you know, it's January and I'm reinvigorated, so maybe this year.
Excellent. Yeah, that'd be cool too, to be able to see the documents up online and get them somewhere that people can make use of them. I've got some of that I need to do as well, and it's a daunting task. I've got what deck owners would call the entire wall of orange for a particular version of VAC's VMS operating system. I found these locally. Actually, somebody was either going to give them to somebody or recycle them, and no, that could not happen. So I got them. It's 20 to 30 binders of material, and I don't think that they're online anywhere. So I scanned the first few, actually offered to pay my son to scan some of them, and he scanned 2 or 3 of them, and he's like, well, okay, that was fun, but I'm not going to do it anymore. So I got to figure out what to do with these guys. Hey, it's not my turn. It's Michael's turn to tell us what your projects are for 2018.
Well, like Paul, I think I'll be dusting off the 2016 and 2017 goals, but the main one I think is also for me is scanning. So I've got my Fujitsu flat sheets, or sheet-fed scanner. That's all set up now, and I've started to use that. And my DIY project is I'm looking at building a book scanner. So now you keep coming across things that you can't take out of a ring binder or whatever and drop through a flat sheet scanner. So I want to have a look at what can I do for scanning books that I don't have to spend stupid dollars buying a commercial scanner. So that's on the scanning front. On the hardware front, it's... trying to curb my habit of buying things that just look interesting. So I don't know if I'm going to try and just concentrate on a theme or anything this year, but I'm just going to try and just like cut back a bit. Though, of course, if anyone does think they've got something very interesting, I'm quite welcome for you to send me an email. And I'll buy it anyway.
And so it begins.
And so it begins. Yeah, 2018. Well, those goals are right out the window. But no, it's mainly to get the mythical scan pile reduced. Well, the physical scan pile and get onto the mythical reducing of it, I think, is my main goal for this year. Yeah, just too many things I've just been buying over the last couple of years. Oh, yeah, I've got a crappy photocopy of that manual, so I'll get something new and I'll scan that. And, it's sitting right there beside the crappy photocopy.
Nice. I'm sometimes tempted when I see, something I bought for quite a lot of money, and then I see it listed on eBay for cheap, I will buy the second one just to lower the average on the first one.
Yes. Yeah, that's not, right. You reduce that unit cost. Yeah.
Not entirely rational.
rational?
Well,
what is this rational?
Yeah, you make up for it in volume, is what you're saying. So I hope that you have some success with that book scanner idea, Michael, and I'd be interested to see what you come up with on that, because it's not just that some of the things that you get are in that format. It's also that with some of the old books, you don't want to destroy them by taking away the binding and scanning them. I had a book, an old retro book on Forth, and it turned out that the binding had already broken on it and pages were falling out. And so I didn't feel bad about debinding that book and running it through the page scanner. Mm. But, a lot of the old books, and as I recall, you have quite a collection of books. That's one of the mainstays.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons. Yeah, because a few of the books I just have, last year I was just flipping, just thumbing through the library to grab a book to read, and you open the book and suddenly you hear the cracking noise as the soft cover, the perfect bind, is now gone all brittle.
Mm.
And, you don't want to open that up flat to put onto a flatbed scanner, or they will start falling apart, and that's the problem. So, some of these books, you need to, rest them on something, so that's why I'm sort of having to sort of have a look to see what can I do as a book scanner. The commercial ones are just a little bit out of my price range, or at least the price range which I could get the financial controller to sign off on. But,
Interesting. Well, Carrington, mm-hmm. What about you? What are you going to do in 2018?
I want to start collecting lots of stuff. No.
Are you going to just tell me you're going to still be you in 2018?
I'm just going to keep on keeping on, baby. I also do have things, and so I want to get rid of them. I still have some stuff in my life. I have two big Rubbermaid tubs that have all the boxes of retro games, essentially. I have mostly Apple II stuff. And I thought I had one big Rubbermaid tub. So to find out that I have two, that just crosses the line. So I want to start getting rid of stuff quicker. Usually it's like I wait till I review something, and then I'll stick it in as a giveaway or something. But I think I'm going to start to throw stuff up on eBay or something just to – it weighs on me having so much stuff. So my second bin, one bin's got to go. But as for projects, I have a problem. At the beginning of the year, I will set – a retro project that I'd like to do, but it's kind of open-ended. Last couple of years, it's been things like I want to be able to code in 6502 assembler, and it's like this vague idea that I want to get better at that, actually get good at that period. But I'm not working towards anything in particular, so I don't seem to get anything done. So the I was thinking about this a couple of weeks ago, and I have a few ideas for projects that I could do that I could present at Kansas Fest. And so I think it's a nice thing to give myself a specific goal. So I've thought of a session I could present at Kansas Fest that would require me to make a thing. And then that's a nice, concrete, specific goal I can give myself. So soon I want to start working on that. It's Apple II sort of music related in a weird roundabout way. So it's very different for me. It'd be a lot of learning. And so I'd like to do that ahead of time. Otherwise, it will have to become my Hackfest project, and I think it's too difficult. So maybe I will actually work on that ahead of time. That would be cool. Otherwise, I know what my Hackfest will be, and so I can accomplish a goal in some way by the middle of the summer. So that's about as fixed as I can get.
Well, that sounds good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's neat. Well, I have one too, and I don't know if it'll actually happen, but I'm going to give myself a swift kick to do this. For a few years now, I've toyed with the idea of writing a book on the hobby of retro computing, and I've even talked to a couple of you guys mm-hmm. about it. And this year, I just got to do it. I'm going to, pull out the stops and dedicate some of my discretionary time to getting this done and interviewing a bunch of people and getting photographs and all the stuff to try to chronicle the hobby that we're all interested in. And it's going to be, a big job. But I've got some momentum. Some things are already committed to paper, as it were. In electronic form, but that's my deal for 2018. By the end of the year, I want to have that book at least in a draft form, if not completely done.
That's cool.
At least I won't have to scan that one.
Yeah, that's right. No, you can buy the ebook. Okay, well, it sounds like we've got a busy 2018 ahead of us, so maybe we should talk about what's going on recently here. We've got some listener feedback. Paul, do you want to take your normal position here as the king of feedback?
Yeah, sure. Tony wrote in to tell us that... So I'm actually pretty far outside the ZX Spectrum world or ZX Spectrum world, but there was a... a kind of like a programming tool set called ZX Modules, which... the author of the sort of the maintainer of is basically stopping. So there's a write-up on Vintage is the New Old that kind of talks about, sort of covers the fact that this will cease to exist. And we'll have a link also to the ZX Modules page. There's a Facebook presence, which I think may actually be gone by now, or it was supposed to be, but the actual site will stay up, for another year. I think he was sort of surprised that there was actually even that much interest. But so you have a year to sort of get your hands on these, just in case you are also like me outside the ZX Spectrum world, but want to be in it and develop for it. 2018 is the time. And is this something familiar to anybody else here on this call?
No, but I like the ZX Spectrum.
All right. Well, it's the same here. I've just gone to the Facebook page, and it looks like that there is the obligatory, this page will be removed within the next 14 days. So, yes, he has hit the button, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So I suppose if he's not going to be maintaining the library, I can understand sort of not keeping the Facebook group open. But, it's always a sad thing when something... passes on. Looks like a great set of utilities and things for ZX Spectrum programming, and hopefully someone else will keep that community's Facebook presence or forum space, whatever they want to use, active. But when someone retires from what they've been doing for a while, it is a sad thing to see them go. But as long as it's in the Internet Archive, I suppose. It'll be preserved forever, or at least the modules will be. I don't know if you can back up Facebook pages and groups.
Not easily. There are things. I mean, quite possibly only the owner can do it. I'm not sure, but there are ways that this stuff can be backed up. Although one other thing about this is that. It's unclear to me of whether the source code is going to be out there. So it might be that these programs will continue to exist, but you have to, in 2028, you're going to have to run them on your virtual 2018 machine.
And that's the thing that I think didn't occur to me at first. I was like, why would you sunset these things if they're programming tools for computers that haven't been changed in decades? Why do you need to get rid of them? Like, what kind of maintenance would there be? But of course, these are modern Windows programs to help you work with old ZX Spectrum. So as Windows changes, you do have to keep refreshing these things. So it would be work to keep them up and going. These are not things that run native on a ZX Spectrum. So it does make sense that it could become eventually overwhelming, though it's always a shame when something is just, you know, deleted versus saying, hey, I'm not going to work on this anymore, so here's the code, or I'm not going to work on this anymore, but here it is in the Internet Archive. So hopefully it ends up there. Internet Archive is a good place. That might come up again later in the show.
Foreshadowing. Okay, so Tony actually also sent another link. I mean, I guess I'm not sure how the feedback is distinct from news, but anyway, this is a small link. It is a one-line C64 game, and I don't think it's actually new, but it's actually really quite hilarious. So it's like, you know, like one single line of code, but it's actually, I think it only spans like two or three vertical lines, even on the Commodore 64, and it is an arcade game. It's like a, I don't know, like a slalom game or something, essentially. You're sort of going down through a star field, and you have to try to avoid the stars. And it will, if you crash into a star, it will crash the program. And if you succeed in sort of crossing the screen, I think 10 times, it will end. And the cool thing is it's just one line. And it's actually, I found it actually a bit more interesting, even in that it seems to make use of some kind of way of interacting with the Commodore that I don't understand, that uses these, like, the Petsky characters or something in some meaningful way. Maybe, Earl, you can understand what's happening there, but I can't read the basic line that is typed in.
Well, with Petsky, you can, within a string, do cursor movements. So I haven't seen this program, but perhaps that's what it's doing. You can clear the screen. You can arrow yourself to a particular area on the screen. You can erase things, or basically you can encode screen operations within a character string.
Yeah, that may be what's happening. It'd be sort of interesting to take a look at it, but it's just kind of a neat little thing. You know, somebody, I forget, it says something like, after months of development or whatever. And it could easily be that it was being refined over a long period of time. But there's a little video that shows it being typed in and then running. And then there's, I think, also an embedded emulator that you can play yourself if you'd like.
I am playing it at the moment. Well, we speak. Doing pretty good, actually. Yeah. I'm just saying.
Yeah, it's an interesting little exercise, because it's actually sort of a surprisingly contentful game for how much there is. I mean, like, you know, there's things to dodge, there's collision detection, there's a counter of how many times you sort of hyper pass through the walls to the right, to the left. Pretty cool.
Oh, you can do that?
Yeah, that's how you win. You have to, if you run off the right edge, you'll show up on the left edge, and you have to do that 10 times, and then you've won.
Oh, cool. I was just going down the middle. Oh, I died. Oh, your advice was terrible. I was doing great by not going to the side.
Yeah. I think actually also in the very last row, there's a safe space, so you can put yourself in the last column, I mean, and then, like, go, you know, shopping and come back.
I beg your pardon?
Because that's what you do when you stop playing your game, you go shopping. But okay, let's see. So the last thing I'm going to mention is we got an email from someone whose name I'm not sure I'm going to pronounce right, but it's something like Gislin, talking about an upcoming game. It's under development and has been actually since for about a year, since February 2017. It's called Realms of Quest 5, and it is for the VIC-20. And it actually is. I was kind of hoping that this was just like a game that somebody decided to call Realms of Quest 5, but in fact, it's a successor to 3 and 4, at least, and quite possibly 1 and 2. Although it does seem like, you know, like a machine generated RPG game name or something.
Yep. Or as you pointed out, it's reminiscent of the Doctor Who thing, the Curse of Fatal Death.
Yeah. Doctor Who story titles are always like, this is like the Curse of X, or the Fatal of Y, or whatever. They are pretty good. Anyway, the anticipated release of this on physical media is going to be sometime before the end of 2018, and it'll run on a VIC-20 with a 32K expansion. If you run it on physical media, it'll take 4 floppy sides, although the recommendation is to run it off some sort of flash media. But it looks pretty amazing. I mean, like, I am not that deep in the VIC-20 world either, but it looks like it's better than I would have expected a VIC-20 could do. So, anyway, there's a couple of threads, on one on the VIC-20 denial forum and one on RPG codecs that sort of walk through the development of this, and it's there, you know, many, many pages of posts about it.
Very cool. So the VIC-20 limited graphics resolution, obviously, but apparently this game requires that you have 32K of RAM. So you need basically a fully beefed out VIC-20 in order to be able to play it. And some of the screenshots look kind of interesting on this. So kind of cool. People are still putting out stuff for the VIC-20, and the denial forum has been an internet watering hole for VIC-20 people for just about forever.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of a nice concept. Like, I refuse to accept that the VIC-20 is obsolete.
Exactly.
Yep, I'm in it's amazing.
Permanent denial. All right, well, we should get to the items of interest and news, which, as Paul pointed out, are only subtly different from listener feedback, but they're things that we've picked, curated, selected with you, our listeners, in mind. I really don't know where I'm going with it. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Carrington. So UNIVAC, big computer, lots of lights, but what can it really do?
Well, sometimes the American elections for president result in very surprising results. And in 1952, CBS decided to do an experiment. Presidential election, or the election in the states. So General Dwight D. Eisenhower was up against Adlai Stevenson, and going head-to-head for who will be the next president of the United States. And, of course, the CBS was trying to win the television viewership, like get the highest numbers watching. So they decided that what they were going to do was bring in a mainframe computer that could predict the results of the election after only a few of the returns had come in. So they'd wait till about 5% of the returns had come in, and then the computer would make a prediction based on the data it had, because people programming the computer said that they could accurately predict the results of an election given only a small subset of the initial data. So CBS said, let's do it. On air, they said, this is not a joke or anything like that. This is actually an experiment, but we're going to do our best. So, but 5% of the stuff comes in, they fire up the UNIVAC, and the UNIVAC says it predicts that Eisenhower will win 438-93, like just a crazy landslide, which had not been predicted ahead of time. Eisenhower was the person in favor, but it could go either way. UNIVAC says, nope, going to be a complete overwhelming landslide. Eisenhower's going to trounce Stevenson, I'm sure of it. So CBS says, no, we're not going on the air with that. That's crazy. You have a bug in your code. Do it again. They make them change the formula a bit. They revise some things, and it comes out and says, okay, now we're, instead of being 101 odds, we're going to say it's like 8-7 in favor of Eisenhower. So CBS goes live with that. Oh, we've got it in. We think it's going to be close, but the computer says it'll be Eisenhower. After going live, the programmers look at what's going on and say, oh, nope. We did make an error in the second one. The first one was completely right. We're telling you it's going to be a complete landslide, which is what happened. So the computer had predicted 438-93 for the electoral votes, and in the actual result was 442-89. It was just a complete trouncing. And so this is a video that's been posted about the election results, about UNIVAC making this prediction. So it's, I think, a chunk out of a documentary. That's how it seems. Not a very long thing. It's on YouTube. Really fascinating. So you can see the actual CBS television reporting of this, and then you can see a bit of documentary footage where people are talking about how, you know, no, they should have stuck with their guns. The computer was right. This introduced a whole new world of being able to predict these things computationally. And then there's also some follow-up CBS reporting that you can see from the day where they were saying, well, you know, the computer actually did say that, and we made them go back and change it because we didn't believe it. But next time we'll try to, have the courage of our convictions to actually report what the computer's really saying. So the whole thing's very fascinating. I didn't know any of this had happened. So if you're interested in Big Iron, maybe you already knew that UNIVAC had done this. It was completely new to me, and it's a short little video, and it's well worth watching. So it's fascinating to see a computer come in, and you can actually see a change to the way computers years will be used in something like politics and statistical predictions and see how it happened live. It's a fascinating little video.
I think one of the most fascinating things to me is that now today, with literally trillions of times the processing power that we had in the days of UNIVAC, we seem actually farther away from being able to predict what's going to happen in elections than we were then. I mean, UNIVAC got it right on the money. So maybe we should bring back UNIVAC.
Or bring back sanity to your elections. Maybe they were easier to predict in earlier right. days. I'm just saying.
Honestly, it would be easier to bring back UNIVAC. So very cool. Well, Michael, I'm just over the moon with this next topic.
Yes, none of this newfangled UNIVAC. We've got some even newer stuff. So this is the Apollo guidance computer. So there is a lovely short, no it's not, it's an hour long video. And by the time you have watched this video, you will either be a AGC SME or, like me, totally confuzzled. So this is actually quite a good video presentation, link provided, with good graphics explaining how the Apollo guidance computer works. Now, there was one line in the Hackaday write-up which I found amusing. And it said that the actual Saturn V rocket was more exciting than compared to the computer. Well, I beg to differ. The Saturn V itself is just really a giant bucket of stuff which someone then lights up and it shoots up into the sky. Big deal. I love the Apollo guidance computer, and this presentation is beautiful. It takes you through, steps you through beautiful graphics. Great presentation. Do put aside the hour to watch it and try not to skip forward. It is good. So is there anyone else on here, guys, who loves the Apollo guidance computer or the breakthroughs in computing that the Apollo program and its predecessor programs got going?
Moon landing was fake.
Yeah, I was going to say, is this like a question like, is the Pope Catholic? But I wish I knew more about it, and I think watching this will lead me to know more about it.
Yeah,
I want to do that. Back in the day, I was a big fan of the space program. As a young lad, I got up to watch the moon launches, and that, you know, late 60s was such an exciting time. I was only six or seven when we landed on the moon, but boy, I tell you, I was so into it. But I don't know that much about the computer systems that they used, and I'd really be interested to watch this too.
Yeah, I think one of the major breakthroughs of it was actually the size of it, what they are able to pack into the AGC compared to the computers of the day. Now, yeah, you know, really, it's comically simple what they were doing with it by today's standards. But, we are talking about putting a computer into the Apollo capsule back in the day, where computers were basically things that took up large amounts of room, physical space. And now they were looking at how do we get this kind of compute power into a small capsule and then run it remotely. Yeah, you know, so like, yeah, you know, we can't tether it. There's not going to be any data cables or anything back to a computer room. It's all got to be able to run by a couple of guys in bulky, cumbersome pressure suits inside the capsule, and you know, it worked. Mm. The amazing thing is, it all worked.
A nice predecessor to like the Scott Adams adventures too, with like the verb noun.
Yes.
Yeah. Display memory, drop torch.
Yeah. Land Eagle.
And you've also got a link here to something. Is this a recreation?
Yes, this is a link that had been provided to us. So someone's going through everything that they've done with, I believe, with an Arduino, building it all up, lovely bit of laser-cut case, a nice presentation case for building your own AGC. So, you know, here's the first step, you know. Build this then build your capsule, then go down to the shed in the backyard, build your own Saturn V, and corner the kerosene market, and yep.
I think Wallace and Gromit did this, right?
Of course they did. Yeah.
Okay.
If Wallace and Gromit can do it, everyone should be able to get in there and do it.
But yeah, the kit looks pretty cool. Bob pointed it out to us in an email, and it's you know, it's on Instructables.com. It is, as some of the commenters there observed, it's almost like an ad for the kit, but it's super detailed in how this is put together. You know, this is basically the build instructions for the kit, and there's some thing that I don't quite understand that Kickstarter will be used for something. It seems like you can buy the kit now, so I'm not exactly sure what Kickstarter is for, except perhaps some, I don't know, gauging interest so that things can be bought in bulk or something. I don't really know, but
yeah, quite a few people are starting to use Kickstarter more as a ordering system. So if they can get a threshold to bulk purchase some components, and then you know, those who have made the pledges, once they reach the projected total, then their money is committed. So if I did get this kit, I suppose it would be, let's be honest, it'll be sitting in the big drawer right beside my Raspberry Pi PDP emulator and a few other projects, but I'd at least have it. And I might trip across some good intentions one year, maybe.
Yeah, it would be cool to have, and it would be cool to use. I do kind of doubt that once I've built it, I would really, you know, do many simulated landings.
Yeah. So, like, what are you really going to do with it? And I think I would rather... I've tried an AGC emulator, and, you know, just doesn't quite really do it for me, having something like this emulated. I think a little bit more tactile, a little bit more in your hands might interest me. But, I'd like to get it. But is it going to be 2018?
Yeah, but as we always say, you know, that may be the only year it's available.
That's so right. Yeah. Buy now, procrastinate later.
Yep. Right.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, well, if the lunar landing game is any indication, I wouldn't want to have anything that would simulate a lunar landing with me as the pilot, because there'd be a lot of crashing going on. Maybe I'd get better. But, Paul, so Lisa OS source code to be released. So a couple questions for you. Mm-hmm. First off, it's pretty neat that that's going to happen, but I don't understand the pomp and circumstance why it hasn't already happened. What's going on with this?
Yeah, I think they've been working on it for a while. I'm not exactly sure what form it's going to take, but I know this is basically, I think, the Computer History Museum pairing up with, you know, sort of working with Apple to make this possible. And they I think, did the DOS 3.1 Apple II source code release earlier. But so Al Casso posted to the Lisa list, which is it's a Google group, you know, mailing list kind of thing, basically just saying, you know, just wanted to let everyone know that the sources for the OS and the Lisa 7.7 applications were recovered. The phrasing of that suggests that maybe it was not trivial. You know, that maybe it was on a disk that had failed or something.
Yeah, I bet something like this has an amazing amount of digital archaeology that goes along with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the message itself that sort of announces this is pretty short. First of all, there's just, you know, conversion to modern standards. Anyone who's had to deal with text files in any time, in any of the sort of recent past, you know, understands the fact that for some reason, all of these different platforms use different end-of-line conventions, and that was kind of a mess. But there's also something that involved a program called Disk Image Chef. I don't know what that is, but again, it sounds like this was a non-trivial recovery effort and not just simply Apple's giving permission. So, but anyway, the idea is that pretty much all of the source code will be released once Apple has kind of given its approval to say that, like, there's no sort of currently viable code in there. And I think that was, even though obviously it's not going to be used to run the Lisa, I think there are things that are descended. And actually the dictionary, the spell checker, will not function because it has the American Heritage Dictionary as part of it. So unfortunately you'll have to, you know, spell check your own documents on your Lisa. So, But it's pretty cool.
So there are actually some IP potential hindrances in this.
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating. So, something so old, and yet you've still got some things in there that they're hanging on to from either a copyright reason or some other kind of, we got to look and make sure, you know, nothing in this is still saleable. It's just, it's kind of amazing to me.
Yeah. So I'm not sure actually even what the timeline is supposed to be, there's a write-up on Gizmodo and it will, let's see, the actual announcement was Christmas Eve, basically, end of 2017. So, and it will be made available sometime in 2018. So we can all prepare ourselves to, you know, make the next version of Lisa OS.
I'm prepared.
But yeah, anyway, it'll be neat. It'll be neat. And there's actually, Lisa has gotten a fair amount of attention of late. I don't know. I'm not sure how many of those things we'll talk about, but some of them. So it'll come back.
I hope we find out the backstory of the actual getting the source available and out. As important as it is in itself, I think I'm more interested in the backstory of why did it happen? How did it happen? What was involved? Who worked on it? That's the kind of thing, that's a story that I want to read.
Yep. Agreed.
Those kind of write-ups, yeah, I agree. Those are really interesting. For instance, you know, there was a lot of work done on the restoration of the Xerox Alto at the Computer History Museum, and the fact that it was restored, and I actually got to see that Alto when I was at the VCF West a few months ago. As interesting as the fact that they did successfully restore it was all the process that they went through to restore it, the things that they had to do at a software and hardware level to get it functioning. And when they do things like this, like the release of Apple DOS, and there were a couple of other really prominent things that the Computer History Museum worked on also in terms of source code releases, weren't there? What were some of those other things that they release, because there was some really good work coming out of there.
I seem to remember that Microsoft Word may have been one of those, like Word for Windows or something like that.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
But yeah, no, it's great that they're doing that. I hope there are people who are really like digging into it. Although I like the idea that, you know, the Lisa OS is going to be released, I'm really not convinced that I'm going to spend the time to understand it, you know, at any deep level. But it's excellent that it's possible to do that, or it will be.
Yeah, it'll be there for historical research, for you know, just preserving the digital heritage of a variety of things. Very, very cool. And you know, like you guys have mentioned, a non-trivial amount of work to, if nothing else, you have to get it from the format that it was in to some format that would be readable by us today. And probably if you just dump it without any sort of documentation or explanation of context, the utility would be reduced. So you need to also be able to document somewhat, well, this source was compiled with this kind of compiler, or, you know, this kind of thing. And then, did we lose somebody?
No.
I don't know.
I'm here.
Carrington, are you still here?
Uh-huh.
Does anyone know how to drive this new Skype to actually add him back?
I tried. I tried dragging him back in. It wouldn't work.
Yeah, I don't like this. I don't like the new Skype. Things should be like they were. Oh, there he is.
Hey, Carrington. How you doing? It's us.
Yeah.
Hello.
Okay, there we go.
Yeah, we are.
That was my attempt to come back in silently.
Yes, worked very nicely.
So that was so subtle, no one will notice.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
Exactly.
So
that happened because I had to sneeze. So I went to because there's no volume control of my mic, so I thought I'm going to do this professionally. I open up the system settings, and I just turn the volume down to zero, and I sneeze. And when I turn the volume back up, Skype says, oh, I see you plugged in a new microphone. So I switch over. I'm like, do I want to do that? Do I not? It is the same microphone. I sat there looking at it going, I should probably just leave that dialog box up. I click yes, everything goes silent. Yep. I'm like, oh, Skype, you got me again.
All right.
So the Lisa was released in 1983, and what was going on in France in 1983?
Ooh, nice segue. So in France in 1983, there was Minitel. And Minitel, kind of, you know, the small sibling to, what would it be, Maxitel?
Maxitel.
you know, a lot of people have kind of minimized the, and this article points it out, that the impact of the Minitel system in France. But in fact, many, many years before everybody was using the internet, France had a well-functioning online bulletin board and news and interactive purchase system that they were using, and it was working very well for them. And it was called Minitel, and this article on IEEE.org will tell you all about it if you're not familiar with it. They kind of jump-started the chicken and the egg problem by making terminals for this online service available at no charge to French citizens. So you'd go, I don't remember if it was the post office or whatever, but you'd go and get a terminal and bring it home and plug it in, and boom, you're on this online service where you could look at the news, or you could buy rail tickets, or you could have interactive chat with people. And, you know, we're talking the 80s. So if you wanted to do that in other places, like I know in the U.S., to have that kind of functionality, I had to pay bucks to get on something like CompuServe and have basically the same functionality that they had. And I would encourage people to read about it, because this really was a precursor to a lot of the things that we take for granted on the internet today. It wasn't as firecracker circus up in your face as the modern internet, and who knows, maybe that was a good thing, but certainly a lot of useful information out there. Did you guys read much about Minitel? Have you guys looked into that at all?
I was, every time I read it, I was sort of, I'm always jealous about what they had when they had it. And even in this article, they've got a photo of a person sitting down with their Minitel with a credit card reader paying her bills. So like, yeah, going online, swipe your card, pay your bill.
In the 80s.
In the 80s. Early 80s. Mm. Online. Oh, amazing. I just love it.
I remember hearing about it, you know, in French class. Which was kind of cool.
Really? You know, well, that's fascinating.
My French classes were several years after this 1983 introduction.
So this went on for, I guess, a decade, and then eventually gave way to the internet proper. I think probably much in the same way that bulletin board systems that were so popular in the 80s, and even big bulletin board networks like FidoNet and that, started to wane after everybody was able to jump on to the public internet. But anyway, it's a fascinating read. Like most of the things on IEEE.org, they take a detailed look at this. It's not just a two-paragraph clickbait kind of article. So would recommend it. So moving on to other digital archaeology, like we were talking about earlier with the Lisa, we go even further back and talk about one of the precursors of the Lisa, the Xerox Alto. And apparently a zero-day vulnerability discovered, and I'm not sure when Xerox is going to release a patch for this. But Carrington, why don't you tell us about this?
This is amazing. This is like the best news thing I have been able to contribute to our show in forever. So people were working with a Xerox Alto, which is, you know, one of the dream systems. Those things are amazing. And they came across a bunch of disk packs, like the big big round, I don't know if they're reel-to-reel. I think they're actual disks, but they're just like, you know, 14-inch big disk packs. Turns out that some of these, there was an option to password protect disk packs. So, while they're working with this system, It also turns out that it's easier to kind of bypass the Xerox completely if you're just reading these things. There's Raspberry Pi setups you can connect to the drive so you can read in the data quicker, etc. But they were running into the problem that you would every once in a while come across a password protected one. So what do you do as a modern day archivist? Well, you figure out how to break the password. So they looked into the documentation of it, and the documentation from Xerox did say it just gives a moderate amount of security because it's fairly easy to break around this. This article describes how they looked into that, like how the passwords are stored on the disk, where they're stored. There really is just like a single bit flag that says, hey, I am password protected or not. So you can just, you know, go on and just change that flag just essentially by writing directly to the disk in a certain space, and then you will have disabled the password. But of course, that's not as fun as figuring out how are these passwords stored, what is the hash, or in this case, a hash with a fixed salt, it looks like, and then being able to work backwards and determine what were the passwords on the disks, because that would be much more interesting. So they determined that as well, figured it all out, and released all that all at once. So we have a zero-day exploit for the Xerox Ultra. Calling it a Xerox Day exploit. But one of the best things is, so this article is amazing. It will give you all the background on how these passwords were stored, how you can get around the password protection, and also what the formula was used to hash the passwords and how you can now go backwards and figure out where the passwords were. They also found a problem with the methodology that's used to store the passwords, that if you used more than 7 characters, it would kind of truncate it from the end, so you'd have a password where the first couple of characters just ended being AA, no matter what you typed, because of the way there was like basically a bug in the code. So they ended up with a bunch of passwords, and it shows what the passwords were. And they were kind of remarkably bizarre strings, like better passwords than you might think you would get. Like AA, there's one AATDAFD and one that's HGFIHD. So, you know, pretty good passwords. None of these are just the word password. One of the most fascinating things in this article is after you read the whole thing, scroll down, read the comments. One of the comments comes from a fellow named Doug Wyatt. Doug Wyatt says, this is remarkable. It's my Alto, your disk you are breaking into. And he goes, this disk clearly was one of the things I was working on APL stuff with another fellow. I remember this. This must be what's on those disks you have come across. It's my old disks. Here's what the password really was. If you got AATFDAFD, I bet you it was ADDATADFAD because I originally worked at this thing in 1974. And at Data General, there was a bug in the code when it was supposed to come up with this word additional. It gave up a garbage word, ADDAT. And so we started making that an inside joke, and I used that as my password. That's why it's that. I mean, this is remarkable. Yeah. So this whole exploit is interesting. The way the passwords are kept and the bug being found is interesting. The fact that the original owner of the disks then found this blog and posted what that password would have been and why. All of this is fascinating and mind-blowing. There's some great photos. Highly recommended. If you have any interest in these topics at all, either the Xerox or old password protections, this is a Run, Don't Walk article. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's very cool. That comment is excellent.
Yeah, the comments are as excellent as the article. Love it.
Well, it's actually, I mean, like, so we're really lucky that Ken Sheriff is doing this. Like, not only working to get to restore the data, but he wrote it up in a way that someone could find it, and we get this piece of history that we just never would have gotten. So
yeah, the whole thing was incredible. It completely blew my mind reading this. It's such a fascinating write up, and it's written up in a way that I could completely understand everything was happening as well. So it's a nice overview that a layman could follow, and it really, really good.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that article myself and the comments that followed. I agree. I think that's probably one of the most fun articles that I've run across in a while. And speaking of people who write well, Michael, is this a new podcast by Bench Edwards?
Yes.
I haven't run across this yet.
Yeah, it's a new podcast, and it's a new tech podcast, and before everyone just runs away or hits fast forward, it is actually different from all your other modern day tech podcasts. This is The Culture of Tech by Benj Edwards. Now, Benj does great writing, and I'll say this now, he does great podcasting too. Episode 1, Steve Wozniak and Television. So This one by with the Woz is great. It is some stories which I hadn't heard before, a little bit of stuff I had heard, but Benj actually moves the conversation along, so it is something new, it is something different. Then he keeps this vein up. Episode 2, Richard Garriott and the Virtues. So rather than just talking about Ultima and what Richard Garriott is up to, this is talking about the Virtues system that he brought in, I believe, in Ultima 5. It is a great podcast. It is a great listen, and I strongly recommend that if you want to hear something different in your tech podcasts, this is definitely one to add to your listening list. I am just so waiting for the next episode to pop up into my feed. It is great.
Yeah, he really started with some obscure people there.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. It's fantastically done, though. Yeah.
Yeah.
If you can keep getting these luminaries and getting them to chat in this same manner, it's great. It was a great listen. At first I thought, oh, Steve, but it was actually mostly new. It was stuff which I'd only aware of some of it on the periphery, but it's very different when you hear Woz actually talking about something different for a change.
Mm-hmm. I agree, and I was surprised that I found the second episode, the one with Richard Garriott, even more fascinating. I figured, like, the first one, it's going to be Steve Woz, the show will be downhill from there. The second one, where they get really start talking about the idea of technology and ethics and the nature of that. I mean, this is fascinating stuff. And it's great that he's got these luminaries on it, but I am on board now with this podcast. Like, even if you bring on people I've never heard of, whatever, they're talking about such interesting topics in a really good way. And Benj just brings a lot to the table. So it's an amazing show.
And he does his own music.
Yeah. It's also a platform for his music.
Yeah. It's Benj and some other guys.
Yeah. But yeah, I guess I haven't listened to the Richard Garriott one for some reason. I'll have to go do that.
Do yourself a favor.
Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, I definitely have seen him, Richard Garriott, I mean, talking in other contexts, and I've been amazed at the degree to which he's still there. Like, he still remembers stuff about like the coding of Ultima 2 and stuff like this.
Yeah, there's a great video floating around where he pulls out his binders and shows with the graph paper and how he's working out the different graphics for Ultima 2 and how they were done and why they were done in a certain way and stuff. It's amazing his memory of those esoteric details is still so sharp. Yeah.
Well, I guess this is good news and bad news in a way. It's good news that there is yet more high-quality, interesting content with subject matter that I'd be interested in. But bad news is I don't have time to listen to it all.
Yeah.
There's just so much these days that's coming out that's just awesome. And, you know, speaking of which, apparently there's a couple of new interviews from David Grealish that you were going to talk about, Paul.
Yep. So, if you had subscribed to the Intellivisionaries, right, you could pause that listening, and then you would have all this extra time.
Yes, indeed. Super long.
With their 12-hour episodes.
The Coco crew is coming in pretty, pretty long, too, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yes. So David Grealish, you may remember, is one of the founders of this very podcast.
Who's that guy?
and he took sort of a hiatus from podcasting for a while. He did the history of personal computing. Yeah, but that's also sort of paused. But he's posted a couple of new episodes to the Classic Computing Show feed. One is with John Woodall, who is the person behind VintageMicros.com, and then one is with Todd Meyer, who's part of the Sapient Technologies organization. And they are both these are sort of a paired set because they're both being interviewed about their current LISA projects. So together they are working on this really kind of interesting and strange project, which is to create modern sort of recreations or modern, replacements for the main boards in a LISA. So in particular, they were talking about the LISA 1 and LISA 2.5 had battery packs in the sort of lower right corner in the back. If you open the back, you'll see this little white sort of square. And then underneath that, you will see much corrosion as they've all leaked. That particular board and the motherboard underneath it has tended to get destroyed in all of the all of the Lisa 2.5s and whatever Lisa 1s there are where people didn't take care of that ahead of time. So there's some small demand for replacements, motherboards that got corroded on, and the I think it's the CPU board. I forget which one, either the I/O board or the CPU board that has the battery on it. So so they talk a little. The interview is kind of about that project and how that's working. Most of what John Woodall was being interviewed about was his connection with the Lisa. But if you've ever kind of looked on eBay for anything, you will have noticed that VintageMicros.com has a lot of stuff. Although he's kind of the Lisa source. And oh, actually, I should maybe also mention, on the Lisa group on Facebook, he has quite recently become pretty active. Like recently he's been posting some pictures of some interesting stuff that he's found, along the way, like a huge fort made of Lisa power supplies and things like this. but he has had some really interesting stuff pass through his inventory. And so, that's been kind of fun. But anyway, these are interesting to listen to. If you have any interest in the Lisa or think you might, this is definitely worth listening to. And it's good to hear David back.
Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to mention Jason Scott's new show as well, right?
Well, we're talking about a great podcast. Jason's is another one which I'm thoroughly enjoying because it's stories. It's stories about, mostly Jason Scott, but things that he's done, things that he's doing. It is great. It is a great dialogue. And Jason Scott is very listenable. I mean, if that's not a word, mm-hmm. It is now.
He's someone who really knows how to speak in a way that will keep you captivated.
And it's a very no-frills podcast. I just love it. I really look forward to his podcast when it comes out. And in all honesty, Benj and Jason's podcasts are basically at the top of my listen-to list at the moment.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, to backfill a little bit there, Jason's podcast is called Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. And both his podcast and Benj Edwards' Culture of Tech podcast are also Patreon projects. And in particular, Jason's podcast was kind of born out of the realization that he was kind of buried in debt and he had to kind of deal with that in some way. And so he sort of launched this, that motivated him to start this as a Patreon project. And it's been successful in helping him deal with the stress of being in debt like that. And that approach is nice because his podcast is great and very interesting to listen to. And at the same time, it's somehow better than just donating to the Information Cube,
Yeah. He's honest and upfront about why he's doing it. And he is a great speaker and I'm more than happy to be paying for it. There are quite a few podcasts that I donate to or do regular subscriptions to, and Jason's is just a delight to listen to. Benj's, again, a delight to listen to. So, and David, yes, I like you too.
Yeah, David also a delight to listen to.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, but no, I agree with you. It's good to hear from David again. He pops up every now and again with a podcast interview, and they are a great listen. So mm-hmm. There's some good people doing some great work out there. So thank you, everybody.
Mm-hmm. It's just like when you donate to someplace like the Internet Archive, you can feel really good about it. He said, foreshadowing.
Yes. You foreshadowed your foreshadow of your foreshadowing. So, yeah.
However, I also do want to clarify too that the podcast, you are free to use Patreon to, help out the podcast, but you don't need to. Like, if you can't afford to help, they're still available.
Yep.
Yeah, you subscribe. We'll have links in the show notes so you can scurry off and subscribe to other people's podcasts. We won't be jealous.
It is kind of a neat hearkening back to the world of patronage, right? Back when you had artists and musicians and folks of that nature who would create works that everyone could enjoy but needed to eat or something like that. And so having the ability to donate to those projects and having it be facilitated within this, what's that big word, disintermediated way, you can put your money in, go straight to the people that are doing the work, and it just, I think that whole concept is such a neat thing.
And Patreon handled it so well.
Yeah. Another case of whoops apocalypse.
Well, so Michael, you've got the last item here. And I have to admit, I took a look at these photos and was just entranced.
These are beautiful. So what I have here is a link to analog control room porn. That is what it is. It is Soviet analog control rooms. These are the things. These are the pictures that sort of like give me that warm fuzzy feeling. But of all of them, about 2/3 of the way down, we have a picture of a control room, funnily enough, lovely wooden furniture in there and a big bench, and three guys that look like they're working in a bakery.
Yeah, exactly.
So that is one heck of a bakery if they've got to have a control room like that.
That's an early microwave.
Yeah, I just love the whole aesthetic of that picture. And is that a parquetry floor that they're actually on with almost like carpet tiles over the top of in the center with those lovely wood grain consoles and drawer units there. That's got everything in it. You know, parquetry, wood furniture, analog panels, displays, and three guys doing the baking.
it's just amazing to me that the arc of that whole panel. I mean, it's 180 degrees at least, right? Of just controls, nonstop controls. How can there be that many things to control in anything? I don't know.
Well, the rising of the yeast that is very important, and then that's just the temperature control of that probably nuclear oven to bake the daily bread and just to get that special glow in the dark crust.
It's so good, people stood in line.
Yeah, that's right. But this is nice. So I have nothing more to say than here is a link of some great looking analog control room paneling. It's beautiful.
The first picture was just so compelling, and they had a nice big version of it that you can click on, and with the knobs and the dials and the readouts and the and I was mentioning before the show, I never would have been allowed to work in a room like this, because just like Homer Simpson in the nuclear control room, I would have been pushing every button. Hey, what does this do? And because it's just that all these buttons and knobs say push, turn, do, you know, all the things. And this first one's just so colorful, too. It's I don't know what these control flow diagrams represent, but there's a couple things up at the top that definitely look like a nuclear reactor. So very nice photos. Thank you for pointing this out, Michael. And now, without further ado, a note from our sponsor.
Atari would like to thank you for taking us into your homes. We wish you all a happy holiday.
So now on to the host's retro computing gift idea. It's a new year. It's a new start. We can think about the community at large with this gift idea. Remember, this episode of RCR is about caring. And so if you so if you care about our digital heritage, and if you're listening to this show, you probably do, then one of the ways that you can express that with real bucks is to donate to the Internet Archive. And we'll have a link in the show notes, archive.org/donate. You're not just donating to yourself when you do this. You're donating to the broad spectrum of digital archaeology and storage and the availability of information to all mankind.
Mm-hmm. And you can donate as a repeating thing, like a monthly thingy or a one-time link, and donations are tax deductible because they are full-on fancy-pantsy charity.
Oh, they're a 501c3? Oh, very nice.
I'm going to say yes. Oh, yep. Okay, look, 501c3. I don't know, some American term for you get a thing off your taxes.
You get a kickback on your taxes, right.
Yeah, somehow I don't think that's going to work for me. But I donate.
Well, we don't pay taxes outside of... Nobody pays taxes other than in America. Don't tell them.
I didn't know they had a recurring donation thing set up as well. That is awesome. Yep. And, you know, obviously we know they do fantastic work. So that is the very first gift idea of 2018. Yay, Internet Archive. So now we're on to eBay auctions. Carrington, where are your auctions? I don't see that you...
I looked and I couldn't find anything. Like, just stop buying stuff. It's not going to fill any void in your life. I looked. There is nothing on eBay I would even recommend anybody else to look at. I looked for half an hour today. I could find nothing.
I just need to look in my list.
Paul took yours.
Yeah,
maybe.
Paul took all the ideas. There was one of Paul's that looked kind of cool. Like, he's got a pet. So pretend that one was mine.
That's fine.
Okay.
That's fine.
Perfect.
I could find nothing. Oh, wait, I see Paul has just moved it up to me. So my choice, apparently, is this rare and beautiful Commodore pet. The 2001 pets, I've always been fascinated by because they have a keyboard I hate, but I covet these machines anyway. I have a very complicated relationship with retro computing. Most of the computers I love have something about them that I despise. And the 2001 is like the archetypal one of that. So this choice is a gorgeous, clean PET 2001. I think the PET is one of the most beautiful, weird-looking 1970s vision of the future computers. And the 2001 is the nice one that has the, like on the left-hand side, it's got the cassette recorder, but it's got that teeny tiny, square, awful chiclet keyboard. Like, it's a computer designed not to be typed on. But it is the exact model that was in a school when I attended, I think it was either beginning of junior high or end of public school, it was the computer that was in the computer monitor room. So if you finished your math homework, we finished math work early, you could go down the hall and you could play with the computer. And this was the computer I got to play with at school. So while at home, I had a Heath thing, I had an Altair, eventually an Apple II and a Cocoa. But for me, the 2001 computer, the PET, is the play with that school computer, and I loved it and I coveted it, and we did some programming on it, and this is a completely gorgeous version. It looks like it just got created. It is $800. The shipping must be $10 billion because these things weigh a million pounds. Nobody should actually own it. They're too heavy and they're kind of useless, but it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. So it is my choice. And Paul's choice. Together we bring you this beautiful Commodore.
Carrington, I think you should buy this one so that you can keep it in Canada.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Oh, is it in Canada?
Yeah.
Oh, it is in Nova Scotia. I hadn't even noticed that. Oh my goodness.
These are really neat.
And there's a few of them on eBay. They come up fairly often. Like, there's another one on right now that is, you know, $400 or so, and it's just as clean, but it's a, you know, place a bid nonsense. And this is a straight buy it now. $800 and it's yours.
But, you know, oftentimes with the 2001 with the chiclet keyboard, the keys are pretty chewed up. Because that would tend to happen over time, is that the little plastic on the top would lift up and some of the graphics characters on there would get smudged out. This one looks like it's in really nice shape.
I don't think this one was ever used. This one looks like it was sealed in plastic after it was bought and has just been recently unsealed. It's crazy new looking.
Yeah.
Well, if
Even
you look
inside.
At the close-up of the keyboard, there's a little bit of grime on here.
So that's how they came. Commodore was a pretty bloody company. Like, that's as
QA,
good as they could do.
Yeah, that's right. Low on QA. Computers for the masses, baby.
But just a keyboard. Imagine a keyboard that was just like this tight, small rectangle. And on the bottom, the space bar is simply the width of two characters. So look at your keyboard now. If you're in front of a computer, look at your keyboard. Imagine your space bar was just centered under the N and M keys, and that's how big it was. And that's all you get. Oh, it's so ridiculous.
Or just look at your iPhone.
Or look at your iPhone, yes. Typing on this is like typing on an iPhone.
I don't have to imagine. I used this extensively in our computer lab. And the reason that I used it was this keyboard. This actually started me down the dark side of Commodore, because in our computer lab, we had a TRS-80 with dual disk drives, and it was like Lord of the Flies trying to get on that thing. I mean, people were elbowing each other in the head.
Like a TRS-80 Model 1, or which one was it?
It was a Model 1 with the expansion unit and a couple disk drives.
Nice. And see, that had a great keyboard.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was a very nice keyboard, and it was a very nice version of BASIC, and thus everybody wanted to be mm-hmm. on that computer. Or you could sit at the teletype, the ASR33, that connected to downtown, but you know that was also very coveted and controlled usage. I mean, sometimes we would sit and use the punch tape to create our programs before we dialed up, because computer time was so stinking expensive. But nobody wanted to play with a PET because of that keyboard. So I was like, okay, I'm going to take a bullet for, you know, my computer hobby here. I'm going to use this one because nobody else wanted to use it, so I could have it anytime. And it was great. I think I still have repetitive stress injury from trying to type on that keyboard. But, definitely an iconic one. Do they show it if it's working? Oh, they do. It is.
Mm. Oh, the inside looks brand new.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Look at that. Yeah, I'm looking at some of these photos now. How did they keep it that clean? That is gorgeous. Okay, yeah, you should buy this one, Carrington.
No, you should not. Nobody should spend $800 on this computer.
Except for you.
It does have a make offer as well. I mean, like the $800 is the be sure you get this nice one. But you could also say, this is how much I'm willing to pay.
Right. Well, I don't want it at all. I just covet it. I covet, but I don't collect. That's what I said recently on Twitter. I love these things, but I don't want to fill my house with them.
That's a good idea. That way you've always got the free-floating anxiety of want, but never the satisfaction of have. So, all right. Continuing with the glasses half full, I have an eBay auction here that I really liked because it was just weird. I don't know if you guys saw this, but apparently the listing has ended. Somebody actually bought it already.
Oh, I wonder who. Oh. I wonder who.
Was it Paul?
No,
he was too slow.
But that's okay.
Oh, my goodness.
It's still interesting. The back catalog is full of ended auctions.
I'm going to go with this one anyway, because
we could do a sort of in my collection in a, oh, it says it'll be delivered by January 31st.
This is really neat.
Oh, Michael.
That there are these CPU holder / die / like carriers that were gold. I don't imagine they're gold all the way through, but they're gold-plated. They had a chip in the center. They look very decorative because in the center, you would have the area where the actual logic of the chip would be laid in and then covered with a ceramic, like one of the old ceramic CMOS chips. And then the nice gold legs stick out to the side and connect up to this gold frame, this square gold frame that goes all the way around it.
Yeah.
And it's just a beautiful looking artifact, and apparently were used back in the day, honestly, to be the carriers for these chips.
So, Michael, you bought this, and what are you going to do with these things?
I don't know, but there goes my resolution for 2018 about not buying so much stuff.
It was like an hour ago we were talking about how you weren't going to buy so much stuff.
Oh, this just...
And now you're buying 1960s chip carriers, because these will be so useful.
These look so pretty.
Yeah.
They really are pretty. Wait a minute. Did you really buy these?
Yeah.
Excellent. It's so cool.
I'm now very scared to look at Paul's listings.
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, whenever I'm looking for
stuff.
You
have to take pictures of these because these are so beautiful.
Yeah, I will.
Anyway, that is awesome. Okay. Well, great. I'm very happy that I chose that. Michael, what else do you have on your eBay list?
What I have up for offer
are some gold chip carriers.
Well, I don't know if those gold chip carriers will work with my first selection, but if you've got a small space in your retro computer collection, about the size of a double-door fridge with ice maker, here is the perfect purchase for you. You'll have to go into a bidding war with some others. There's five bids on it at the moment. But it's going for quite a reasonable price right now. I think it's going to go crazy, but it's currently up to $1,675 with five bids. If you want a PDP-8 with a Deck Graphics 11, oh, this has got everything. This is beautiful.
Lots of fixings.
Oh, yes, lots of bits. And I don't think it's going to arrive in your letterbox. You're going to have to, it says may not ship to Australia, but I'm sure if I really set my mind to it, I could make this one appear. But, this is beautiful.
It's two completely populated racks of stuff. Yeah. I mean, it's massive.
And, so it's got some data packs, extra trays, and there's also a printer.
Uh-huh. And the 8 in this is in really nice shape.
It is.
At least it looks so in the pictures. I mean, the toggle switches look like they're in good shape, and it's a thing of beauty.
Yeah, and it's one of my favorite color combinations for a PDP. It's beautiful. As Karen said, two fully populated racks. Oh, it is heaven. It's almost enough to make me want to go and start collecting PDP-8s.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, one of the things that's cool about this is that it's not even just a bunch of interesting deck stuff. There's also history here. And this is basically the, it's most of the pieces that were involved in this kind of, like, experiment working with blind people to look at sort of ways that you could get sensory information to them all in an alternative route. But so there's a photo of some of the experimental setup, and there's, some of the equipment that went with that experiment too. I mean, it's a sort of preserved package here. It's not rather than just a bunch of things that fit together.
If I got this, I would want to find out as much as possible about how it was used, where it was used, the info that they've put in here into the eBay auction item is one beautiful teaser.
Uh-huh.
I just hope that it goes to a wonderful establishment.
I don't think Michael should have two racks of computers designed to experiment on people.
Shh, quiet, Carrington.
This will not end well for anybody.
Look, this is going to hurt you more than it's going to hurt me. But I've been told I'm not allowed to do animal experiments anymore.
Well, that restraining order was not me.
No.
I'm just saying.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Now, ever wanted to be a millionaire? Here is a package to help you get a little bit of practice on the stock market. So this is Millionaire 2 by Blue Chip Software. It looks like a fairly complete set, but it's quite an interesting game. I believe with this one, you start with about a $10,000 portfolio or $10,000 to buy a portfolio, and you do your investments. So, it's one of those fun little simulators of what can we do with computers, game type things. So it's a nice, complete set. The box folder it's a little bit squished, but that's probably because it was right there beside Carrington's game when he sat down. But
right, yeah, this one actually is a Millionaire 2. Is a bit rare. Like there's a predecessor to this.
Yeah, just Millionaire. Yeah,
yeah, that was more popular, but I haven't seen many of these. Of course, I just bought one. And now they're showing up. But whatever. Mine's sealed.
But if you bought this one, would that help reduce your unit cost?
It would not. No.
Okay.
But it's not super expensive.
No, it's not. I was actually tempted to buy this one and not put it into my list. I thought that it's a nice buy it now item. If someone's after this style of educational simulation software, it's a good one to get. So download the disk image and then just use the ephemera that comes with it. It's a nice little package, and really for $49.95 buy it now plus shipping, well, outrageous shipping to Australia, so I'd have to transship this one, but I think $50 buy it now, it's a great buy for somebody. And then let's see, the last one I've got is it's just something different that it really, really just caught my interest. So it's not too retro, but it's a retro in its use. So this is a vintage Icon 1000 microfilm viewer. So they're asking $240 if this one's in Victoria, Australia. So that's quite a reasonable price. It's a nice three-quarter size microfilm viewer. And the best part about it is, if you don't want to buy it secondhand, I'll put a link in the show notes, you can actually go to ICOM and buy it new.
Cool. There is something that's very, very sort of pleasingly analog about these things.
It is. You know? I just love using the tray pointer in front of you to just get to the image, the fish image that you're wanting to look at. It's, as you said, it's a strangely analog sort of pleasure of using these. It reminds me of back in the day where I actually had to go looking up archived insurance policy details back in my days of being a calculator. Sometimes some of the older stuff had been archived on microfiche, and you basically just had to go get the right packet and then go up to the reader and find the one that you want and then get a horrible quality print of it, and then take those details away and do whatever you needed to do with it. But it is a strangely pleasant analog activity.
There was something I don't actually know what, you know, maybe it's just sort of a general method of distribution, but I know that there was a fair amount of IBM stuff distributed on microfiche.
Oh yeah, yeah, a lot of bulk things. I'm just trying to remember all the other things that we had. So yeah, but yeah, it was a way of distributing printed information without taking up volumes of physical space, and you could actually just pop things in the mail. So mm-hmm. Yeah,
no wall of orange.
Yeah, no wall of orange. You can have your little viewer.
I have the wall of orange actually had come up. Maybe it was last time. I think one of the eBay auctions I had last time was some VMS orange manuals, and I definitely have the kind of a nostalgia for those as well, just because I remember looking stuff up.
You just miss out on all of this beautiful aesthetic these days when you just get a PDF. It's just not the same.
No.
And they don't even include the PDF in your purchase. You got to go and download it yourself. Oh, shocking. Oh,
like a savage.
Yeah. Okay, so that's it for me. So, Paul, what have you got for me to buy?
The first thing is out of my price range.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's I guess, some of the things we've already talked about have ended. This will be ending before this gets edited and out fairly soon now. But it is a Lisa 1. It is currently at $55,700, which is about what I anticipated. I have joked on Facebook that I'm kind of hoping it ends at 68,000, but probably will not. I don't know actually what I can't quite guess where this is going to go, but of course the Lisa 1 is a super rare thing because the disk drives were so unreliable, Apple basically just replaced them all with Lisa 2s for free. I think it was for free. If it wasn't for free, it was for not very much, so almost everybody ditched their Lisa 1s, long before they were going to sell for five digits. Anyway, so it's interesting to see where this goes. This is probably the first Lisa 1 I've ever seen on eBay in the time that I've been looking. So kind of fun to watch. 76 bids so far. It's in Germany.
And how much is it going for?
So much money.
Just about $56,000. So.
Wow. It's just as all. Yeah. All going for all the money.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, the thing about this is I'm pretty sure I have actually seen a Lisa 1 up for auction, but not on eBay. And I'm not convinced eBay is the right way to go for something like this. This is a little bit too precious of an item. But there it is. Mm. So I think there was an Apple 1 that was sold on eBay too. So, again, wouldn't have done that, but here it is. So we'll see.
Yeah. I went into the bidding history, which is a bit boring because it's a private listing, but starting price of $1.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, fairly confident it's not going to go for one, so might as well.
Yeah, 76 bids. Mm.
And still 5 hours to go. I mean,
that's right. Yeah,
no one.
It could get to 68,000. You never know.
Yep. But okay, so that's that's interesting, just as an interesting thing. But the Next one I have, the next one I have is an Osborne 3 computer, and I, to be honest, did not know that the Osborne 3 computer existed, but here it is. There is one for sale. It is, in fact, actually by the same person who had listed the PET. So this is someone who collects computers and is now, you know, it keeps them nicely and is now unloading. Yeah.
Decollecting.
They're decollecting.
But so I did know that the Vixen was the 4. And I knew that the executive is the 2. So it stood to reason that there would be a 3, but I never knew it before. So if you wanted to see what an Osborne 3 looks like, here it is. I think it was not a CPM machine like the other ones. But anyway.
I'd never heard of this. This was so cool to see. I didn't even know that computer existed.
Yeah.
Apparently, like yourself, I was unaware that there ever was such a thing. So even though I won't be doing the eBay purchase, it was neat to see the pictures.
Mm-hmm. I love that last picture there, the end profile. Oh, I love it.
Yeah, the Vixen, too, was actually a pretty cool shape. And I think of them as being completely unobtainable, but of course, this I had never even seen before, so this one. The starting bid is $299, which is not crazy.
Oh. Yeah, buy this as your daily driver. It'd be immune to Meltdown and Spectre.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's true. That's true. No speculative processing on this.
No.
The next one I wanted to talk about was, in the show notes, I called this as the You Might Have a Problem Mac Lot, because I saw this when I was looking through things. I would not recommend anyone get this, but this looks just like... it looks like those piles of things that you save because someone says they're going to recycle them. So the person who's selling it is asking $300 for it, and that's not appropriate. It's a pile of PowerMac G3s and some keyboards. And
they're not even G3s. I think they're 7600s or 7500s, which are not G3s.
Yeah, good question. I see one that's a 7500.
Yeah, so if they're... I mean, they all came in that same case... But the 7500, which is kind of the crap of the 7000 series, because it was a weird series. Uh-huh. 7100 was a good one. 7600 was a good one. 7300 came next, bizarre. Uh-huh. 7500 was that kind of janky 100 megahertz 601 processor one.
Oh, was it?
Nobody would want to have, let alone three of them. Yeah. Good case, though. That whole case series was
really
amazing.
Like those.
One of my favorite cases of the PowerMac.
And... Yeah, I have a bunch of them, and there's a piece, I forget what it is now, but there's a piece that breaks off of every stupid one of them, because the plastic's gotten brittle. I forget what they called it, but it's name of a mountain or something like that. Yeah, but
so which one is the one that you have a bunch of, Paul? Is it like the 7500 or which
let's
model?
See. Let me just look around here. I thought they would be in sight, but apparently I do have a PowerMac G3 sitting on its side looking at me.
Because the 7000 series, though, I mean, they're pretty good for networking.
Yeah,
they've got all the network stuff built in. So bring a few of those down to Kansas Fest and we could have like a marathon session or whatever.
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, I sought out a 7180. I had one of those, you know. I think I do have a few of these 7500s that I actually did salvage from the, you know, recycling.
Because I've always thought of the 7600 and then the 7300 are really the models to get of those, because you can get them as like a 200 megahertz 604. Mm-hmm. They're like, you know, pretty tricked out computers for that era. Like if you're going to do play things like Marathon and its spinoffs or the games that came out in like mid-90s, then they're pretty good computers and they can be gotten fairly cheap.
Yeah.
Not that you should buy things, but
yeah. But yeah, don't buy this, but because it really is just a pile of.
But don't buy this.
This is something.
And for $300 or something, like this is a crazy auction. It's a pile of garbage.
Yeah, yeah.
Literally.
So. Okay, let's see. Next one I have is a pretty complete TI-99 4A system, and I think my impression is, I didn't follow this up, but my impression is that the seller actually has a number of TI-99. For a things, but this is kind of like a nice complete thing. It has a PEB, you know, a peripheral expansion box that's full of all of the little things that you would want in it. So that's probably the main selling point of this. It's a nice clean machine. you know, the downside is it's a TI-99/4A, but you know, it looks really nice. It's, you know, it costs a lot to ship already just because of the PEB there, but it's worth taking a look at. If you were interested in this, this is a nice way to just get everything at once.
You can kickstart a collection with this. Like, you have a really nice setup and kind of be done, except for maybe picking up some more cartridges. Mm. But you would just be finished collecting, essentially, if you got this.
Yeah, it's got the manuals. It's got some other bit of software there. The multi-plan, if you want to, you know, do spreadsheets. Very cool. If you really want to kickstart your collection, then there's somebody's basement is for sale, basically, for $500. This is the second time this has been listed, and the first time it was listed, it was $1,000, I think. And even then, I thought, that's cheap for this.
I don't understand how this hasn't sold.
Yeah. So maybe it is sold by the time anyone's listening to this, but it's basically, you know, I think it's an estate sale, but it's a really nice collection of, like, PC Junior stuff. There's a bunch of compact Macs, a dozen or something. TRS-80 model, what is it, 3, I think, with a printer, a bunch of image writers, and there's a big pile of more TI-99/4A stuff, Aquarius stuff. It's basically, you know, it's like one of us, right, who is no longer with us. And so
I'm still here.
Yeah.
Is that why Jack is not on the podcast? Right.
He's headed off to wherever this is, you know, Chicago, to pick this up.
No, I thought maybe he's dead and this is his basement stuff. Because the nice thing is the way this is set up, the display is in a basement that is full on awesome retro.
Yeah.
With the
wood panels.
The wood panels and this drop ceiling. And it's just like, it looks like a photo that was taken in the late 80s by a multi-billionaire who could afford to buy all the stuff at that time. Yeah. But didn't have an interior decorator.
Yeah, the photos are great. I assume that what is partially blocking people from having bought this is that you basically just have to go to Decatur, Illinois to get it. So you have to pay the $500 and then get yourself there and back. But if you're in Chicago, no problem.
Or maybe if I'm going down to Kansas Fest through Chicago, I can pick this thing up and basically say, I'm bringing down the garage sale giveaway this time. Because this is it.
Yeah, it's a little early yet still, even for the super, super early arrival. But
no, I want to go super early arrival. I'm basically just saying.
6.5 months early or whatever.
Yeah. I can't believe we're still only doing Kansas Fest once a year. This, come on, guys. I would totally go more than once a year.
If you don't have anything and you want to instantly become a collector, this is a way to just become.
If you are Carrington, but you'd rather be Paul, right. This is the way to do it.
And I mean, you know, honestly, if you were just going to be mercenary about this, you could resell that for way more than this.
Way, way more. Yeah. It's crazy. You could easily get 10 times your money on this by just flipping these things just a little bit a piece. It's so much stuff. Yeah.
The PC Junior stuff actually is, it's all in its boxes, you know, it's like, it's relatively uncommon. So, all right. The last thing I have, right, is this NEC PC 6001 Mark II computer from Japan. I don't know very much about these computers, really. I think it's kind of cool looking. It seems to work. And it's got, you know, Japanese on the keyboard, so that's also cool. But,
So these were pretty neat. I worked for a few months for a weird retailer, and during that time we had some weird computers, and one or two of the ones were these NEC models that you don't hear much about or see very often, but they had a nice keyboard. As I recall, they had a nice version of BASIC, and they were just kind of, you know, quirky outliers that I enjoyed. I thought they had a nice ergonomic style to them, and so, anyway, a kind of fun little niche in the retro computing world.
It says it has 5 different BASIC versions in ROM that you can. There's actually a picture in the auction that shows the selection, so that you can pick the version that's compatible with the thing you want to do. It has RGB out, which is pretty amazing. I just can't get over I really like the Japanese there. So Earl, maybe you know what is the key that is under return on the right, that's by this little light. Do you have any idea what that's supposed to be?
I need to bring up the photo again. Give me just one second.
Sure.
So let me, so under return, that is Ka and Na.
Oh, yeah, I see. Keyboard selector.
I don't know, but there are a couple of Kana characters in Japanese. So it could be that...
This was made in Kanada.
Right. No, isn't that the... I thought Kana was the actual, like, the word for writing system, basically, right? I mean, like...
It is.
Yeah, so, it's got it seems to have an indicator light beside the key switch.
Then that probably switches back and forth between
the... So if you hit the Kana character, right, like a shift key. Mm. Oh, there you go.
Cool.
Yeah, I like how it's got... Is that warm air cup warmer on the right-hand side?
Hopefully, yeah. Mm. to keep your green tea heated. Mm.
Just at the right temperature.
Anyway, yeah, I like it. It's, it's $200 buy it now, so I'm probably not going to buy it, but it's cool. If I could find the thing I would actually really kind of like to get, although they cost way more than is worth it to me, is the Apple II J Plus. There was a, small numbers of these Apple II models that were made for Japan and actually have the sort of Japanese characters on the keyboard and character support for it. But they are super, super rare. Anyway, that's it. Those are my things.
Good things.
Thanks.
Well, I guess that takes us to the closing of the show, the opportunity for parting shots, the airing of grievances, things of that nature.
Feats of strength.
Feats of strength, right. So, Carrington, why don't you go first?
Sure. I have very little to talk about. My life continues as always. I'm a happy guy. Oh, I went to Belize. I think I talked about that on some podcast recently. I don't think I talked about it on this one. My girlfriend and I went down to Belize and stayed in the jungle and went exploring caves and Mayan ruins and horseback riding through the rainforest, and it was awesome.
Yeah, you're right. Oh, I have heard about that. Oh, it must have been on the Eaten by a Grew podcast.
Hmm. Yeah, that sounds likely. Hmm. I probably talked about it on Eaten by a Grew. It was amazing. Like, just crazy amazing.
So did you pick up any retro Aztec computers?
I did not, although we did get to see tablets that were used to compute stuff, like when the sun would set and when harvest was to start. So I did see, like, stone-based computers, in a sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was pretty cool, though. It was a fun trip.
Wow. What an adventure. How cool.
Yep.
So, Paul, you've got something here in the closing statements. Something about cardiac?
Oh, yeah. So I think a couple of times ago there was a cardboard computer. I forget what this was called. It's kind of an acronym in the way that they kind of made acronyms in the 60s, where they would just pull random numbers of letters out of every word. So it's like four words put together to make cardiac. But it's a cardboard computer. It's a CPU simulator in cardboard that was supposed to be kind of like an instructional tool. So it's like, cardboard instructional assistant for computing or some sort of thing like that from Bell Labs. But so I now have an actual little piece of cardboard from the 60s to teach you how CPUs work, which is pretty cool. Haven't done anything with it, but I will. It's unpunched too, mostly. I mean, it's like new. So I thought they would be harder to get. Turns out not really, but
yeah. Yeah. Cardboard, new inbox.
Yeah. Right. I'm intending to sort of scan it and play around with it, but one or two episodes back, there was some discussion of those. Another thing that was pretty cool, just wanted to mention it, that, whatever Facebook has, whatever merits it has, but one thing I was quite pleased by was that Mark Termal showed up in the Apple II Enthusiasts Facebook group, and this is the guy who wrote Sneakers and Beer Run, which were both, I don't know, important to my young computing life. So among the earliest games I played. In fact, I think there's a person I knew in school who claimed that she was related to Mark Termal in some way, but never did follow that up. And who knows, that may just have been false. But anyway, I was just pretty wild to just see like famous people from the past showing up. And I think he's still in the, or at least recently was in the gaming world and working for somebody. I forget now. Big name. Game company, though. What else? I was reminded that there's a magazine, a very kind of short-lived magazine for the Mac, from the Soft Talk people called ST Mac, which they internally refer to as Saint Mac, but it's supposed to be like softtalk.mac. And I'd scanned these, I don't know, some years ago, actually, a couple years ago, but I never had uploaded them to the Internet Archive. I had just had forgotten. So it was observed, like I was reminded of that, and I put them up. And on our Facebook group, there's been a number of pages excerpted by Limte. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, but he's been sort of finding the interesting pages and posting them on our Facebook group. So if you want to see the highlights, you can go to our Facebook group there. That's about it.
Neato. You got something here too, Michael.
Yeah, I've got a new cat in the house, not of the four-legged furry variety. This is a Dick Smith cat. Also, it was a Laser 3000 in other parts of the world, but it was badged as a cat here. So it's a 6502 machine. And it's nice. It's a nice machine. And the best part about it is I also have an emulator cartridge, so my cat can emulate a certain fruity machine as well, which is the way that a lot of the clones of the day got round that little annoying thing of Apple litigating against them because they were infringing copyright. They could sell the base machine as a 6502 machine with a, you know, Microsoft BASIC, so it's pretty much like any of the others, but you could actually put a emulator cartridge, which basically gave you additional ROM with information in it, and equivalent to a 16K language card. So it turned your wonderfully, perfectly legal 6502 machine into a wonderfully legal but slightly dubious Apple-compatible machine. So I've been having lots of fun with that. And in a separate acquisition, I got a 1986 Dick Smith Electronics catalogue. And in there was a section for computers. And what I liked about it is that it's in the calculators and computer section of the catalog. So, you know, computers weren't their own thing back then, no? But it's got all of the cat console itself, and then all of the different bits and pieces. So there's been a few enthusiasts here who were very happy to get hold of that information from the catalog. So this is one of the things that I want to get my book scanner set up so that I can basically scan the entire catalog without actually opening it up flat and doing it on a flatbed scanner manually, or slicing off the spine and running it through the document fed scanner. So it's just another one of something that I've got here that I need to find in the alternate scanning method. But so that's pretty much that was pretty much the highlight of my collection for the year, to get a Dick Smith cat. So now all I've got to do is get a Dick Smith System 80. So I've got the Dick Smith VZ 200 and 300, the cat, and now I just got to get my hands on a nice System 80 system. I could pop over and visit Tezza in New Zealand and swipe his on my way out. along with his recently archived software. But so that's where I'm at the moment.
So you don't have the emulator cartridge, do you, or do you?
I do have an emulator cartridge.
Oh, nice. Okay. Is it?
Yeah.
Is it?
I have photos of the emulator cartridge opened up as well. So.
Excellent. Congratulations. One of the things I was kind of curious about with that is just, is it compatible? I mean, like, because there was...
We've got ProDOS running on it.
Okay, that's a pretty good compatibility test, actually, because it will...
Yep.
That refuses to run on a lot of clones.
Mm.
So.
I think we got ProDOS running on that one. Just trying to remember the... Yeah, there was in the... news lists there, we found some information on making the earlier versions of ProDOS. But yes, I don't think the later versions of ProDOS work. So now I've got to get an information pack together and send that off to John Brooks and see if we can get a version of ProDOS working for that. It would be lovely to see ProDOS working on that. Even though I'm a dyed-in-the-wool DOS 3.3 guy, I would love to push this little machine to its limit.
Right. Bring it up that extra, like, 0.01% in market share.
That's right.
Well, very cool. And I imagine looking through those Dick Smith catalogs is about as much fun as it was here in the States for us to look through the Radio Shack catalogs when they would come out.
Oh, all the yes, I've got a
techie goodies.
Yeah, I've got a 1980 Radio Shack catalog that's also waiting to be scanned.
Oh, cool. Very, very cool. So for me, I had lunch last week with a prominent retro podcaster. Can anyone help us with our superstitious ritual and guess who it was?
Are we going to say it together?
Yep. I don't remember having lunch with you.
Yep, it was Kevin Savitz, and he brought me two things. One was a Unidisc, and we're finally now getting together, so I can get that disc and put it on my Apple II, and now I'm no longer gang just Unidisced. I am now effectively duo-disced.
Hooray.
So, yay me.
That's cool.
Now I can run all that stuff that you can't run with just one floppy drive, like some of the language systems and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the second thing that he brought me was an idea for a new project. Another element of digital archaeology that I'm not going to talk about yet. I'm going to leave this as a teaser. But it's really exciting and another avenue to plumb the depths of some of the thought and work that was done on old retro computers from the 80s. So by the time we reconvene next time, I may have actually gotten a little bit further along on this, and I'll let you guys know what it is. But until then, cool. You're just going to have to wait.
Excellent. Give people a reason to tune back in.
But Kevin has great ideas on, he just always thinking on this, preserving the digital world kind of stuff. And I guess that's it. Is that it, guys?
I think that's
it. Is that all we got?
Retro compute.
Oh, wait. I forgot to mention, I'm recording this on what is now a retro computer, my iMac from 2008.
Oh,
and 10 years is retro?
I think that's...
That's what they used to say.
3G.
Yeah.
I've got my iPhone 3G in here downstairs with me, so it's now over on the it's not quite retro shelf, but
I was pretty impressed actually. I looked at the battery stats on it, and my 3G claims to have about like a 70% healthy battery, which is kind of amazing.
Wow.
Because at some point it's just going to melt. But anyway.
Well, I, even though Carrington jumped the gun on the retro compute, I think that's it for this show.
That's what editing is for.
And you can find all the show notes at rcrpodcast.com. You know, go there right now. You know you want to. You can discuss us in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php, or you can just go to rcrpodcast.com and click on the link. That's way easier. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group, which you should. If you haven't done already, shame on you. It's at facebook.com/group/RCRpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We're a member of the Throwback Network, but don't throw us back. You can find that at throwbacknetwork.net, and you can write a review of RCR on iTunes, which helps other people find us and also makes you feel good about yourself, I promise. And until next time,
Retro Compute. I've already said it.
Okay.
See you guys.
Very helpful.
Oh, Carrington.
I get that one.